coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. For the formerly incarcerated or homeless, finding a job can be nearly impossible. But workforce reentry programs can not only help, they can change lives.
We have people that are just trying to find a new niche in life.
This week we learn more about the Delaware Center for Horticulture's Branches to Chances program. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Arts Playlist examines why people of color are underrepresented in art and what can be done to change that. And we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A More Just Delaware. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. If you've applied for a job lately, you may have been asked to check a box about whether you have a criminal record or felony. For many, that's not a problem. But for thousands of ex-felons in Delaware, it is. To help with workforce reentry, the nonprofit Delaware Center for Horticulture's Branches to Chances program introduces the formerly incarcerated, homeless, or unemployed to horticulture while working toward job placement and building work-life skills. The center recently celebrated the graduation of 7 program participants. This week, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon is joined by Branches to Chances coordinators Robert Harris and Bonnie Swan to learn more about the value of these workforce reentry programs.
Congratulations on another graduation. Before we get to that, let's unpack the Branches to Chances program. I know it lasted 9 weeks. Bonnie, we'll start with you here, but again, Robert, feel free to chime in. When we say participants, we're mainly talking about individuals who were formerly incarcerated, homeless, unemployed, people even in recovery, right? That's who mostly makes up this program?
Yeah, generally people who are looking to improve their lot in life, who are hoping to find a trade, an occupation, or just a job.
Yeah, and Robert, you actually, it's funny, you had said off air before we started this, just people trying to get back really on their feet, right?
Yeah, that's correct, Kyle. We have people that are just trying to find a new niche in life, you know, something that, you know, they heard about the program through other people, and, you know, they're not really involved in anything right now, and they're just trying to find a new lease on life.
Branches to Chances launched in 2009, correct me if I'm wrong, but this program in one form or another has been around for a while. How does it prepare the individuals we just, you know, talked about? How does it prepare them for reentry into the workforce? What skills or tools does this help develop or nurture?
Well, we try to give them the broadest possible base of knowledge and skill so that they are prepared and supported when they graduate. So we, you know, horticulture is sort of the context for all of the life skills that we want our people to begin to acquire when they start Branches to Chances. So they'll have a lot of classroom education, mostly participative, hands-on kinds of learning in horticulture and related topics like landscape design, native plants, information that they need in order to be able to take care of plants, because the goal of the program is to find a job in landscaping at the end of the 9 weeks. But we also have learned over the years that our trainees need a lot of support or benefit from support. So we provide them with our partners, workplace skill training, wellness counseling, computer literacy, financial literacy classes, all to help them sort of get the details of their lives straightened out so that they're prepared to work when they graduate. Right. We also this year tried something new, which was to have a case manager working with our trainees on different aspects of their lives. You know, some of the trainees come to us with a need for housing, or they need to get their finances straightened out, or they need to continue their education, get a GED, take care of fees and fines that are holding them back. And Bob and I decided that it was too much for us to run the program and keep track of all those development needs that our trainees had. And so we contracted with Jewish Family Services to have a case manager visiting with our trainees once a week. The feedback we got from that is good. So we try to give them a well-rounded experience that touches on different aspects of life that can be challenging when you're coming back from a hard time or getting started.
How does Branches to Chances work then? Like, what does life specifically look like? Again, you really eloquently laid it out. These individuals, every single case is so much different than the next, but all of them come together in this program where there are common threads. What does life look like for the program's participants during those 9 weeks?
Well, it's a mixture of classroom time in classes, working with the public landscapes crew so they get more hands-on experience, taking field trips so that they can see other gardens and see what the world of horticulture looks like, and exposing them to the different kinds of jobs that are available in the industry. So they spend a lot of time at the DCH, but they also get out into the community. And whenever we visit a garden, we try to volunteer there as well so that there is an aspect of community service to all of the trips that we make.
Kyle, I'm a proud graduate of the Branches of Chances program. And it's really great to see how it's grown, how it's improved over the year, how we've become more supportive in various areas from the time I graduated to till now. I mean, we accommodate them in a whole lot of different ways that they're going to need when they get back out into society. The Achievement Center is one of the places that we go, and they do mock interviews. They get resumes made. And one of the things that we've implemented in the last few years is how to get a job, but now we have how to keep a job, you know, workplace etiquette. And, you know, it's a totally different life for some of the people that are coming through the program, because some of them never had jobs before. Some of them never have completed anything before. And it just makes them feel really good to get a certificate for completing a computer class. And the field trips are amazing, you know, because some of the places that we go are so close. You know, Winterthur is right up the street from here, and they've never seen anything like that, how the DuPonts, you know, how they lived. And I mean, it's just amazing. You know, they think it's a hotel and not, you know, someplace where a single family lived. Yeah. Chanticleer, Longwood. I mean, it's just amazing, you know, the different type of gardens that we go to and the exposure that we give them. Davy Tree Service, they come in and show them that aspect of horticulture, how they climb trees, cut down trees, and they give them an opportunity to put on a harness and climb themselves. It's just a wonderful feeling, you know, just to see, you know, their eyes light up when they, you know, see something new that touches them.
What do you hear from participants, and, you know, whether it's what they gained from the program, how it changed or impacted their life? Are there any sentiments that really stick out to you that you've heard from recent participants? Anything stick out there?
One of the things that come to mind is we do financial literacy, and a lot of the people that come into the program have never had a bank account. You know, whenever they get a job, they have to go through the check cashing place and cash your check. So just about everybody that leaves here out of the program has a checking account. And, you know, they know what their credit score is, and they're on their way to raising the credit scores. But the personal stories of, you know, how they can't wait to get out of the Plumber Center, because we have individuals from the Plumber Center, how they can't wait to get out, you know. And one of the things I must say is that we are a paid program, you know. So while they're in their 9 weeks of training, they are getting paid. So they're able to save money and save towards something, You know, some of them have lived in the mission, and you know, they're just very appreciative that we are giving them the opportunity to prosper. You know, a lot of them don't stay in the horticulture field. A lot of them, you know, they may go on to other jobs. One of the guys here, he left here and he went to the food bank because he always wanted to drive a forklift. So he got into the forklift training class at the food bank, and now he's at Bloom Energy down in Newark driving a forklift. Another guy, he got a job at FedEx, driving for FedEx. He always wanted to be a truck driver. So on the weekends, he went to truck driving school, and now he's on the road. And these two individuals that I'm speaking of, they were at Sojourners, which is more or less a recovery shelter type place. So they would get up every morning and leave Sojourners and come here. And both of them, you know, have their own places now.
You know, looking at workforce reentry, though, it's a challenge for so many people out there. Is a challenge for, and programs like this just aren't as common as they should be. That said, from your view, again, as someone who was a participant in this program and a graduate of this program that now helps coordinate it, why do you think programs like Branches to Chances, why do you think they're so important from your view?
I think they're important because they're life-changing. We expose people to things that they've never had exposure to. It's just fun to watch, and it really warms our heart too. I mean, because Bonnie and I have been doing this for a while, and you know, at the end, you know, we hug and say we made it through another class.
Yeah.
You know, it's good to see people, you know, get out and spread their wings and, you know, see how they do.
Thanks to the Delaware Center for Horticulture's Branches to Chances program coordinators, Robert Harris and Bonnie Swan, and our Kyle McKinnon, for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. Arts Playlist is next, with a look at the issue of underrepresentation of people of color in art. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. People of color have historically been excluded from artist spaces, but it's particularly glaring at mainstream art museums where diverse representation is still lacking. And if art museums and galleries are to last through the 21st century and beyond, they must reflect the diversity of the world outside their doors. That's according to art historian Elizabeth Humphrey, who recently put together the There Is a Woman in Every Color, Black Women in Art traveling exhibition to celebrate the contributions of black women to the world of art. It's an exhibition currently showing at the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington. And in this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sits down with Humphrey, a PhD candidate in art history at the University of Delaware, to talk about underrepresentation in art and how it's being addressed.
Art in museums and to a certain extent in popular culture has historically been decided by white gatekeepers. From where you sit, what has that meant for Black artists throughout history?
Yes, so I want to start just by placing myself in the context of curating this and being part of this history. As you mentioned, yes, white gatekeepers, white institutions gatekeeping what kind of art goes on the walls, what is acquired by certain museums. And so I really see my role as trying to intervene and break down those barriers of access, both for exhibitions and the public, but also for living artists as well. And so when I think about where Black women artists have been positioned throughout that history, I can't help but think of the early 20th century during the Harlem Renaissance, you know, people not being able to afford the same sort of pristine materials that one might want to sculpt in with sculpture, for example, thinking of Augusta Savage using a lot of painted plaster versus casting in bronze, not being able to preserve art in the same way as their white contemporaries. And so even thinking about preservation, preserving those early pieces, it becomes a bit of an issue as well for Black artists, especially in the early period.
Yeah, I'm glad you laid that out, especially that preservation piece. I want to come back to that. But, you know, how has that acceptance maybe that veneration, that respect of Black artists and Black art in general. How has that evolved over time?
Yeah, I would maybe describe it as a bit more of a grassroots effort in the 20th century as Black art critics and artists are coming to the table to define sort of what is African American art, term used at the time. What are the boundaries or confines of what is productive in Black art? What is not as productive in Black art? And I think when you really start looking into the history of that discourse, you see a lot of contradicting viewpoints. You know, not everyone is ascribing to the sort of social uplift utility of Black art. Artists like Alma Thomas, for example, sort of moving away a little bit from that social uplift and really exploring creativity, creatistic freedom, if you will. And so even on the spectrum of Black artists, there is no monolith. I think as we move forward into time, the question then becomes, you know, what's the function of Black art today? Are we still focusing on social uplift? Are we allowing Black artists to express their creativity? And so I think those conversations are still ongoing, but perspectives are shifting in a lot of ways.
Well, when you look at those barriers and those factors throughout time, you mentioned specifically almost that recording of the art, that preservation piece here. That sticks out to me as among the barriers and factors. But, you know, again, it's more than just white gatekeepers and white institutions, right? You know, there's other things at play.
Yeah. So when people ask me, for example, why did I curate the show that I curated? I like to remind people that the exhibition they see on the walls does not reflect all institutions, right? In the first installment of There Is a Woman in Every Color, Black Women in Art, that showed less than 1% of the collection, or rather less than 1% of the collection that sort of represented the theme that I wanted to explore. And while a lot of mainstream art museums are certainly reckoning with and trying to fill gaps, historical gaps in the recent past, I'd say in the past 20 years, I always like to highlight the diligent and hard efforts that a lot of HBCUs have been making throughout time consistently to preserve Black and African American art. But a lot of people don't gravitate towards them immediately when thinking about where to find these relevant works, but these jewels have been in these Black institutions for a long time. It's just they don't get the same sort of treatment and notoriety as mainstream museums might.
Well, you touched on a bit there, but you know, so identity we know is central to a work any artist does. You know, you mentioned your exhibit, There Is a Woman in Every Color, Black Women in Art, that obviously more than recognizes people of, you know, and women of color in artistic spaces. But when it comes to an exhibit like yours and museums like the Delaware Art Museum that showcase them, what role do you think that kind of almost partnership plays in addressing this kind of, you know, what we're talking about today, the lack of representation of Black men and women in artistic spaces?
When I think of the Delaware Art Museum's history in Wilmington, also thinking about Black and brown people's not hesitation, but sometimes reluctance or feelings of being unwelcomed in such institutional spaces, I think exhibitions like There Is a Woman in Every Color help to invite people who look like the people on the walls to come in. Sometimes even I experience this feeling of uncertainty of whether I should be in a certain museum environment or not, because I don't see anything on the walls that reflects me. I don't see it in the institutional staff either. And so to be able to present this exhibition to folks who are just genuinely curious about learning and about learning Black women's stories, I think that helps to break down those silos a little bit more.
Were there any concerns? So there's the interpretation piece here, right? And who's interpreting the work of Black artists when it is being showcased? You're looking at something like a case like the Delaware Art Museum that is predominantly white, not picking on them, but that's most art museums in general. You know, what about that though? Like when it comes to, you know, you have a white curators like essentially reviewing or interpreting, you know, curating black artists' work. What do you make of that?
I think a lot of it boils down to the extent to which curators are collaborating with descendant communities, with people in the institutional or artistic space. Where is that partnership coming from? I don't think there's nothing directly wrong with people curating outside of an experience that they identify with. But the question is, who are you inviting to the table to check and balance you? And so even in my own work, I am a Black woman, very proudly. I'm a Black American woman and a curator. And even still, all the stories and experiences that you see in the exhibition are not mine, right? They're pulling from other walks of life, other perspectives within my Black woman community. And so partnering with other students across different ages, getting input from my family members, for example, in the process of curating helps to, I think, just tell a richer story than if someone was curating in isolation. And so I think collaboration is helpful not only for those who are outside of the culture that they're curating, but also within the culture.
When we zoom out and we look at this region and a state like Delaware, one that's filled with really what's a gluttony of, you know, art museums and is rampant, it seems, in the arts in general. You know, I'm curious for your thoughts on, or as what you think of Delaware in terms of being a good place for, you know, Black artists to grow, a place to, you know, nurture their work, to feel like they'll be seen and there's real, you know, possibilities. What do you think about that in this region and in Delaware?
I've seen the Delaware Art Museum makes intentional strides to create those partnerships and collaborations with contemporary artists. I can even think about their recent 1971 exhibition, which really put sort of held the feet to the fire for the institution itself in stating, you know, this is us trying to rectify the missteps that we had in the past. I think those genuine and proactive efforts, I think those should be seen and reflected across other Delaware museums, regardless of, you know, if they have a historic collection or a contemporary collection. I think they should be more proactive in reaching out and rather sort of rather than responsive to the ebbs and flows of what's happening in social injustice. Does that make sense?
Yeah, being more proactive, I can imagine the ripple effects that would have a kind of impact if that was more of the norm. You know, whether in Delaware or not, again, this is a pretty broad question, but what more do you think needs to change so that, you know, Black artists and their work are recognized more often in the going forward? Does it start with, like, again, these institutions and the demography of these institutions? Does it come from the promotion, like you kind of just said, the promotion, the when exhibits like this are up, and being proactive and not reactive? What does that solution, that puzzle, kind of look like?
I think definitely having spaces to show one's work, get acquired by a museum, have an exhibition on display, a major exhibition on display. I think those are definitely sound and needed. As someone who focuses so much on community, though, I think barriers to access are more important in the sense that if people don't see other Black creatives in their network, how are you pulling them together to do peer mentorship? How are we connecting them with the artists that came before them? What sorts of programs are available to help not sponsor but support them into that next step of their career? Are there socioeconomic barriers that, you know, institutions can help to support artists who want to be living artists, not just working in art? Artists on the side. And so I think a lot about how to position people to better express their creativity. And I don't think that always happens just through sort of notoriety by being affiliated with an institution.
Thanks to art historian Elizabeth Humphrey and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up the green next with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A More Just Delaware. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you another episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A More Just Delaware. The podcast examines pivotal moments in legislation related to hate, prejudice, and the fight for equal rights in Delaware. In this third episode, we focus on legislation passed and signed in 2021, banning discrimination based on natural hairstyles. This legislation is often referred to here and other places where it's passed as the Create a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair, or CROWN Act. The primary sponsor of the bill here in Delaware, Senate Bill 32, was State Senator Darius Brown, and he joins us on this episode to walk through the genesis of that legislation, the work to pass it, and where it stands today. So I want to start as we talk about the CROWN Act, Senate Bill 32, that was passed and signed back in 2021. I wanted to start by just asking you, what prompted you to bring this bill to the General Assembly?
Well, thank you so much for that question about the CROWN Act. It is legislation that we passed here in the Delaware General Assembly to prohibit discrimination on hair texture and protective hairstyles such as braids, locks, twists, and knots. Within our society, we recognize within minority communities, African-American communities, but also communities of every ethnic background, there are certain desires that individuals may have in how they express themselves with their hair color, the length of their hair. And so with that, there may be some prejudices given to those individuals when they're in the workplace. And so we wanted to provide this anti-discrimination legislation around removing those barriers to individuals for employment in different workspaces and places, educational spaces that they may be in.
And while this legislation is relatively recent and the push to pass similar legislation around the country is relatively recent, the issue itself is not. It is one that has a long history, correct?
It is one that has a very long history, one that is not always mentioned. But, whether you are male or female, you enter to certain professional settings as a male and you are told to be have your face shaven, to have a clean shaven face, not to have a mustache or a beard or any of those type of things based on the professional setting of your employment. And so some people literally made decisions around someone's employment, someone getting certain positions on a job, not because of their intellect or their skill set, but based on if they had a mustache or, if their beard was too long. And so in the same context with women around the texture of their hair, the length of their hair, the social construct of acceptance to more European looks of hairstyle, which for more ethnic populations, particularly African Americans, would be an unhealthy treatment of their hair to straighten their hair and to make their hair, look more European in hairstyle. And so these are things that have been talked about for generations around employment and outward mobility that individuals have faced within the professional setting. And we recognize that with this legislation, we're removing that barrier for individuals that they really should be looked at upon their conduct, their character, their intellect, their skill set, and not because of the length of their hair.
You've mentioned kind of in broad strokes what this bill covers. Can you talk a little bit more about specifically what it protects? You mentioned it's both the workplace. Obviously, I think you also mentioned education, so I'm assuming schools are involved. Just give us kind of a general sense of what's the scope of what this does in fact require from businesses and schools and others.
Yeah, it generally speaking, it is broad, but we see it most occurring within school settings and within employment. There's been many times in recent history that we've seen student athletes in other states, not so much in Delaware, but in other states, where they were not allowed to participate because of the length of their hair or the braiding of their hair, where literally referees or sporting officials mandated they literally cut their hair that day, you know, before they get on a wrestling mat to perform that athletic feat. And so we recognize the need to have that legislation here in the state of Delaware as a protection against discrimination for our student athletes, and also some of the subtle discriminations that are not always, you know, verbalized that individuals, particularly women, would face of all ethnic backgrounds because of their hair. You know, there is also certain perceptions about women because they have short hair instead of longer hair, and there's discrimination in regard to that. And that's, again, every ethnic background. And so because of how society has changed, evolved, and some of those things that we may have adopted as standards, you know, in our father or grandfather's generations. And notice I did it intentionally, but you notice I said father or grandfather's generation, recognizing that we all have mothers and grandmothers. So being more inclusive in our society and how we address these issues in our policy making.
So you brought this bill to the General Assembly. What kind of work did you have to do behind the scenes to explain the bill and kind of garner support for it? Were there initial questions your colleagues had about this bill as you started to move it forward?
Well, the Crown Act is a national initiative, and so there are some states that had passed it before Delaware, like California, New Jersey, and others. And we were a part of a coalition that was called the Crown Act Coalition. It's actually a national initiative supported by Unilever, which is the parent company of Dove. So for all those that support Dove products, thank you for your support. It helped us in the work that we did here in passing the Crown Act. And so we were able to bring together coalitions of organizations throughout the state. We were able to bring together African-American Greek letter organizations. We were able to bring together owners of salons that are up and down the state, hairdressers up and down the state. We're able to work with in-state government, with the Office of Women's Advancement, with the State Human Relations Commission, and other state agencies like the State Department of Labor, the state, which is now the extension of that, which is now the Delaware Department of Human Resources. But at that time, HR was in the OMB office. It had not been separated out yet. And so we were able to work with all of those state agencies, entities, and partners around public education. We held webinars in regard to it. We had national leaders on the issue that are leading this issue in Congress, in the U.S. Congress, to pass similar legislation at the federal level. Speak to our different partner groups, and we had them advocate within the state legislature to their state senators and representatives where they resided. And so I'm very, very happy and pleased that the Delaware State Senate passed this legislation unanimously. It was bipartisan. Democrats and Republicans understood the issue, supported the legislation. And we had a great ceremonial bill signing where organizations from up and down the state were able to come and celebrate the passage of the bill. And it was fantastic. It was one of those things that we did during COVID. Mm-hmm. So we weren't able to get the whole bill signing thing done because of COVID restrictions. So when we were finally able to get together, you didn't quite know how many people would show up or what it would look like, but to see, you know, over 100 women there celebrating the signage of the Crown Act, it was a very, very rewarding and fulfilling a day for us all.
You mentioned the fact that it passed unanimously in the Senate. It also passed unanimously in the House. I mean, how gratifying was that? Because it sounds like – I mean, I know there was some questions in some of the committee meetings about like fire departments and military schools and how this would affect them kind of enforcing the kind of their, you know, their codes and standards and dress codes and things like that. Tell us a little bit about kind of just, you know, maybe overcoming some of those initial questions and winding up with that unanimous vote across the board.
Right. And I think a lot of that came from what we know just through generations of what requirements were. And for all of us, we had to learn that the military does not have the same requirements that it used to have around being clean shaven and grooming. You know, people have different opinions of that, but, you know, it is not what it had previously been, whether it's in the reality of some family member that we know that served in the National Guard or in the Navy or as a Marine, or if it's even what we've seen on TV that we just adopted as, you know, a standard. And so through the public education of legislators, understanding that the requirements of our armed services are not what we may perceived, assumed, or thought, and then also within our law enforcement and public safety agencies, that those requirements within our fire departments or our police departments and other law enforcement agencies are not what we assumed or perceived or thought. It really helped through that public education process of smoothing the concerns that others may have had. Again, time, society, culture has evolved in such ways that, you know, we have to catch up to it. Mm-hmm. And so this legislation allows us to do that.
You mentioned that this is a national movement, and to date, I believe 22 other states have passed bills like this one, along with a bevy of municipalities. I do want to talk about one of them, Texas, which recently passed it within the last year. And it actually had a case in the courts involving enforcement of this bill or their version of the bill. Just last month, a Texas judge saying a school district there could punish a black student who wears his hair in long locks without violating their Crown Act, essentially ruling that the law as it was written there did not prevent the school from enforcing its dress code. And I guess the question I wanted to ask you is, does that raise some concerns for you, that decision, about enforcement should an issue arise here in Delaware? That, again, as much as we've talked about educating people and people understanding, that it's still, even at this point, likely to be some skirmishes along the way to making sure that this is enforced.
Yeah, the public education piece is important, but also if individuals feel as though they believe that they're being discriminated against because of this, that they make myself, the State Department of Labor, aware of it, so that there could be an investigation about it. And then, you know, from that investigation, the Department of Labor, you know, would determine if this indeed was discrimination. What I will say with all legislation, you know, there may be ways that people try to circumvent a cause or a purpose. For instance, if there are policies within a school that may speak to someone's hair and they don't want to end up having to be, you know, someone that violates the Crown Act, they may say that the student was insubordinate. Well, the child's hair has nothing to do with being insubordinate. But, you know, there may be other policies and procedures that are in some book that a school has around protocol and behavior that they may try to enforce upon that student's freedom of expression. And so make us aware of it so that we can address those issues. I am not naive to think that they don't exist, won't exist, won't come up, but we can only resolve them and continue to make the progress that we're trying to make for people if they let us know about this.
And is that a real concern that someone might be afraid to challenge, whether formally within the school or a workplace or even maybe coming to someone like you and saying, like, hey, you know, I feel like I'm being discriminated. What do I do? Is that a real fear in trying to get people to exercise their rights that they've been given?
I think it's always a concern. I think the reason for the legislation is because there's been generations of experience where it was understood, it was known, it was accepted, you know, and so for so many years, people had to assimilate in ways that were demeaning to them, that were unhealthy to them, both physically, both socially, psychologically. And so by us making these attempts to remove these barriers, you know, I recognize that there's going to be those hurdles and ways that people try to navigate around it. And so, yeah, we absolutely need them to come and say, hey, this is what's going on in my life. This is how I'm being affected. I believe that I'm being discriminated against. And we will, you know, Department of Labor will look into it, you know, fair, evenly, and balanced, and have their outcome and ruling on it. But we absolutely need those individuals to come forward. The only reason why we were able to even pass legislation around the Crown Act is because there's individuals that were brave enough to say, this is what has occurred to me. And, you know, after 20 years of working in corporate America and having to do this for 20 years, you know, this really isn't right. And is there something we could do about it?
And just building on that, I know the one thing that struck me when I was reading about that Texas case was the reaction of the student who was involved after that ruling. And I'm just kind of paraphrasing from the reporting by the Texas Tribune. He exited the courtroom in tears, walking alongside his mother and several lawmakers who had co-authored the Texas law. And one of the lawmakers told the Texas Tribune, you know, she could sense the anger and confusion. And the young man actually turned to her and said, all this because of my hair? And my thought was, you know, when we have discussions like this on a podcast, we often talk about kind of like bigger principles, right? And you know, equal rights and you know, and in this kind of abstract way. But ultimately on an issue like this, it is very personal. And it feels like sometimes we miss the personal stories and impact. Is that one of the hopes you have for something like the Crown Act, that it puts more focus on the personal aspect of these larger discussions about prejudice and civil rights?
Absolutely. You know, many people have preconceived perceptions, and people will call individuals racist. Some of that may be, you know, genuine hatred, but a lot of it is just the lack of exposure to other individuals, cultures, ethnic backgrounds. And so we adopt these approaches to life based on what we deem our standard of behavior and interaction and conduct and so on and so forth are. And so when we get beyond that layer of what we have preconceived about an individual, you know, it's kind of like when you'll see a video of a older white woman getting in the elevator and a younger black guy, and she clutches her purse closer to her. It's just a preconceived notion that we have, that society has taught us about an African-American man or a white woman or a Hispanic woman, you know, that we have. And the best way for us to remove all those barriers and all those prejudices and all those preconceived notions that we have about individuals is to look at ourselves through our humanity. And for this young gentleman in Texas, but I can say even with our legislation here in Delaware, when one of the committee members, one of the senators, had expressed, even though the legislation was not specifically geared toward that population, it's cross and broad enough to support everyone around discrimination protections. But there, you know, a white state senator had brought up and said this legislation would support my son, who has long hair, and I, you know, I don't necessarily like that my son has long hair, but you know, his generation, they have long hair, and Tom, you know, most things in history, if you live long enough, you see them repeated. I mean, you know, there was a time in the 60s and 70s where the thing was for people to have long hair and things of that sort. But no, the Crown Act, beyond just what some people may think is specifically for African Americans or some, you know, civil rights issue and things of that sort, which it addresses, which is its origin, which is how it began, it provides this protection broadly for everyone and anyone. And so the same way an individual may have a preconceived notion and assumption about a young white guy, young white man that comes to the office and applies for a job because he has long hair, is the same, he deserved that same protection as the young African-American male that may apply for the job that has dreads or locks.
And I guess, you know, speaking of it as a national effort, and you mentioned, I think, earlier that there's also an effort to pass federal legislation that would do the same thing. And I'm curious if you feel like, you know, seeing a case like the one in Texas or other places that have had some conflict over this, does that kind of speak to the need for the federal version of the Crown Act so that, perhaps, it isn't just going by state or municipality by municipality, that there is a blanket protection, a universal protection for these type of things across the United States?
Yes. So, I am very hopeful that if not within this Congress, the next Congress, that the Crown Act would be considered and pass. I think that the more states that can do it, locally, it lends its support, lifts the voice, raises the issue. It is a bipartisan issue. You know, it is legislation that is passing in what, politically, people may deem as a blue state or a red state. And so because of that, I think that it's growing, the progress is being made, that ultimately we may see it adopted federally within our U.S. Congress. But we still want more states locally. We still want more state legislatures, state capitals to take on this issue, to bring awareness to it. And then again, for the actual residents of our states, the individuals that are being impacted, to please make us aware of these instances of discrimination so that we can make sure that you have the protections that you need, that you deserve, and all of our state constitutions within the union commit to of seeing individuals' humanity.
Senator Brown, we've covered a lot of ground so far. I just wanted to wrap up by asking, is there anything else you hope the Crown Act accomplishes over time toward advancing the cause of equity and diminishing prejudice?
I would say that I am so happy to see the progress that has been made in Delaware. Again, for us to pass the Crown Act, to see the bipartisan, multicultural, multi-ethnic support of the legislation, the conversations that I know I was able to have with my colleagues of all different backgrounds. Delaware may be a small state, but we are very, very diverse in our population, whether it's the cities of Wilmington, the suburban areas of Newcastle County, the more rural areas in Kent and Sussex, to see the demography that is continuing to change in our state, the population shifts and growth of our state. The conversations are changing. How we develop, cultivate, and create public policy in our state are changing. And so I just appreciate the openness of my colleagues in the legislature in something like the Crown Act and the many other things that we've been able to do in the General Assembly in recent years about adding discrimination protections.
You've been listening to the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A More Just Delaware, with State Senator Darius Brown, discussing the Crown Act banning discrimination based on natural hairstyles. You can check out this episode of A More Just Delaware and others at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. The podcast is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Delaware Humanities is the recipient of United We Stand, Connecting Through Culture funding from the National Endowment for Humanities to support A More Just Delaware and related programming. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Rachel Sheffield at Delaware Humanities and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.